I don't know if anyone here has ever heard me speak, other than those who keep following me around. But the shiur today is going to be very different from other things that I've done. So just start off, let you know there's a story behind this, and I'm not going to start with the story. What I'm going to start with is to try to explain what it is that I do, which I also never talk about. I just go and I do it, and then people have to try to figure it out. There's actually two different directions. It's probably more, but I'll start with two different directions. The various books which I've published have all been somehow around Parsha. It's one on the holidays. Although if you would have asked me 30-something years ago, what would you write about, that's not what I would have guessed. I never would have imagined that. What I would have said is what really interested me much more, and that was the world of Agadah. So even when I got to things about the Parsha, I got it via, at first really through Midrashim, which was like a parallel track to the Agadot, because both of them are words of Chazal, and the expansion of Chazal, and the ideas of Chazal, and that's what intrigued me. No one's interested in learning Gemara, and certainly not learning in Agadot, and what people were interested in here in Parsha Shavua, so that ended up getting spoken about and written about and published about eventually, and so on and so forth. But I want to stop and make an observation and say one thing about a Parsha, not this Parsha, some Parsha, but about how the Midrash works, because that's going to illustrate what it is that I was thinking, and then we'll get to our story, and then hopefully we'll all understand everything. When you read a Midrash, I think what some of us do, and that's because we can't help ourselves because we're somewhat modern people, some of us even postmodern. So what we do is we tend to go off into this binary analysis. Is this true or not true? And if it's true, then it's pshat and then we like it. If it's not true, then okay, different part of our brain, so what is this trying to tell me? Right? And it's just automatically, that's how you read it. Moshe's 10 feet tall, okay, not true. Moshe's head and shoulders of everybody else, okay, I got it. And that's basically the way that we move through the words of Chazal. Now, what we should be doing is to go back to the Psukim and to say to ourselves, now what did Chazal see when they said what they said? What textual problem are they trying to solve? Now, it's not exactly the same thing that I was saying before, because we seem to take it out and look at it completely independently and not even bothering to do that hard work. Now, it's true we sometimes do this with Rashi, because we like to give Rashi a lot of credit. So we'll read Rashi, and yes, we do this or we don't do this. Before there was a book, What Bothers Rashi, I had a teacher whose name was Nechama Leibowitz, and essentially that's what her methodology was, to go back and then to say, okay, what problem is Rashi trying to answer? And then you try to read the text and try to figure it out. Okay, so now let me try again. When it comes to the story of Yosef, we all remember that the brothers threw Yosef into a pit. What does the Torah say about that pit? We'll try this again now, because this is really good. This is like an independent point that people who have unfortunately been raised going to yeshiva have a complete inability of knowing what scripture actually says. So let's try that one more time. So what does the Chumash say about the pit that Yosef was thrown into? Okay, so you're sure the Chumash says that? So we have an argument what the Chumash says. And is this because I'm intimidating you? And that's not Rashi, right?
No, that's Torah.
The Torah says, Habor reik ein bo mayim. So Rashi, okay, there's no water, but there are snakes and scorpions. Now, where does Rashi get that from? So, of course, the right answer would be because there must be some Midrash that says that. What are you supposed to say? You've been a great audience? That's what you're supposed
to say. No, it's the Kefel Lashon.
Okay.
That's where it comes from.
Okay,
right?
Good.
On the text, why would you say Reik and Ein Bo Mayim? Because you're repeating the same thing.
Right. Twice. So, there's actually a pasuk in the middle of Akev. Now, Akev is a parsha that nobody ever learns. Right?
It's the middle of the summer. So
it's not only the middle of the summer, it's also after Tisha B'Av. Right? Like there's no obligation for anyone to learn.
Well, the Rabbanim are in the Catskills.
The Rabbanim are. So there's a pasuk over here, Perek Chet, pasuk Tedvav. It talks about how God took us out and God took us through the desert. Hamolichacha b'midbar hagadol v'hanorah. Now, what is really scary about a Midbar? By the way, where Yosef was thrown, did the Torah describe that as a Midbar or no? It's not a Midbar. Can we be trusting him or no? Okay, I really do trust you a lot. This is just to amuse myself. Okay, Yaakov sends Yosef, right? Go see how your brothers are doing. They say, let's kill him. Now, you ready? None of us remember this. Who in the word stuck the word Midbar? And I know that the last 35 times you learned Bereshit, the word Bamidbar was not in that pasuk. Yes? Should I read it again? But Yom Le Ruvain, Al Tishbuchu Dam, Hashlichu Oto El Habor Hazeh Asher Bamidbar, V'yad Al Tishbuchu Bo, L'man Hatzil Oto, and so on. So they took him and they stripped the clothes off and Vayichu Oto V'shluch Oto Habara V'haborek Ein Bo Mayim. But how do you describe this place? It's the Midbar. Now, what does the Torah say about the Midbar? So again, middle of Akev, vacation, really uninteresting. Hamulichacha b'midbar hagadol v'nora, nachash saraf v'akrav. Oh, guess what? Guess what's in the Midbar, right? Nechashim v'akravim, that's in the Midbar. So apparently, in the mind of the Midrash, when it heard the word Midbar over there, it creates this image, this visual image, if you will, of a place which is full, it's a scary place, full of scorpions. And now, what I just now did, I truly believe that's what Chazal had in their mind. I've never seen anybody say it. Why would I find such a thing? Because that's the way I'm thinking. What made Chazal say this? Now, you're right, there are other reasons to say it, but why do they pick those particular? Why? Where do they get Nachash v'Akrav? What's the answer? Okay, this is scary. Chazal no Tanakh. Okay? Chazal no Tanakh. So Midbar, visualize, where is it? Okay, Yosef is in the Midbar, and they're going to throw him in a pit. What's the scariest description I have of the Midbar? The one that we just now had in Parshat Ekev. And what does it say about it? What does that mean? Nora. Nora. It does not mean awesome. What does Nora mean? Yeah, no.
Scary.
And what defines it as scary? Nachash, Saraf, Akrav. And so on and so forth. So as far as I can tell, that's what Chazal just now did. You get it? We're taking these skills. What are they? Trying to figure out, so what is Chazal doing? How is a story, or the images in a story, connected back? What do they see? What do they hear? So now I'm going to start all over again. And this is really, really quite strange. And I'm going to tell you a story. The story must be a true story for a simple reason. That in 1943, January 8th, 1943, there was an article in the New York Times. Now, if it's in the New York Times, would you all agree with me that that necessarily means that it must be true? Or would perhaps some of you say, well, you know, not necessarily. No, all the news fits to print. And if it's in the New York Times, so therefore... Yes?
Maybe back in 1943. But
it's so nice to believe... I am envious of your naivete.
Nothing changed.
So there was an article in the New York Times, and the article in the New York Times told a story about how 93 women from Beit Yaakov, or Beis Yaakov, which would be how I would call the story, and how they had all committed suicide because the Nazis were coming at them. If you want, I could do one of two things for you. I can read to you the article from the New York Times, which, by the way, is full of mistakes. Does that shock you? Here's the headline. 93 choose suicide before Nazi shame. Because even the headline, as we can still pick on New York Times headlines, there is no evidence that they actually killed themselves. The only evidence that they have over here is that they spoke about that they would kill themselves. So 93 choose suicide. Okay, so you can still play with it, a choice, whatever. Jewish teacher and students in Warsaw, actually the letter that they that this was based on was about Krakow. So we're doing pretty well.
It's in Poland.
Yeah, Poland, you know. Poland is Poland. I mean, what's the difference? Warsaw, Krakow, right? Greenberg, Iceberg. Like, what difference does it make? But just in terms of, I mean, this is the New York Times, and therefore, there certainly would be fact-checking. You can just Google it. Okay, maybe not. But still, 93 Jewish girls, the headline is, there's four headlines. 93 choose suicide before Nazi shame. Jewish teacher and students in Warsaw school foil plan to force prostitution. Letter describes ordeal. Women provide themselves with poison and pray as they await Germans' arrival. So that's the whole headline over here. Am I correct in assuming that most of you at some point have heard about the 93 Beis Yaakov girls? Yes? There are streets named after them in Israel. You didn't miss anything. It never happened. But I'm getting way ahead of myself. Actually, whether it happened or not, I can't be sure, but that's exactly part of our issue. I'll read to you the letter, which, as I said, is not really from Warsaw. It's signed Chaya Feldman from Krakow. So, I mean, that should be a giveaway. So I'll read the letter. You have a Hebrew version of it. I found it in English, and the real one was Yiddish. So I'm not reading that. I'll read the English. 11th of August, 1942. My dear friend, Mr. Shinikarlowski, in New York. I do not know whether this letter will reach you. Do you know who I am? We met at the house of Mrs. Schneier, of course, Sarah Schneier, and later in Marienbad. When this letter will reach you, I will no longer be among the living. So by the way, that's also interesting in terms of fact-checking. Just because somebody says I won't be among the living, that doesn't mean that they're no longer among the living at that point. And I would say a good reporter has to do a little bit better than that, rather than say that they did in fact commit suicide based upon a letter. But and now I'm being very serious in terms of journalism. You don't just take that as information. Together with me are 92 girls from Beis Yaakov. In a few hours, all will be over. Regards to Mr. Rosenheim and to our friend Gutman, both in England. We all met in Warsaw at our friend Scholman's, and Schlomsen was also there. I think in the one you have a lot of names, of course, down. We learned that the land to which this letter goes has sent us bread. We had four rooms. On July 27th, that's the second date that was given, the first one was the date of the letter, the 11th of August, we were arrested and thrown into a dark room. We have only water. We learned David by heart, perhaps Tehillim, and took courage. We are girls between 14 and 22 years of age. The young ones are frightened. I am learning our mother Sarah's Torah, Sarah of Sarah Schneer, with them. That is good to live for God, but it is also good to die for Him. Yesterday and the day before, we were given warm water to wash. We were told German soldiers would visit us this evening. Yesterday, we all swore to die. Today, we were all taken out to large apartments with four well-lit rooms and beautiful beds. The Germans don't know that this bath is our purification bath before our death. Today, everything was taken away from us. We were given nightgowns. We all have poison. When the soldiers will come, we will take it. Today we are together and are learning the confession all day long to say Nidui. We are not afraid. Thank you, my good friend, for everything. We have one request. Say Kaddish for us. Your 93 children. Soon we'll be with our mother Sarah. Yours, Chaya Feldman from Krakow. That's a scary letter. Now, this letter caused an outrage. Actually, the New York Times was not the first time that it was publicized. It was publicized at a convention of rabbis a week or so, 10 days before. People found out about it. This caused an absolute uproar in the Jewish community. 93 girls killed, died, suicide, Nazis, prostitution. The New York Times is January 8th, 1943. I'm going to save you a little bit of work. You can Google this. There are articles. My first real knowledge or understanding of this was by an article that was written together by Judy Baumel Schwartz, and J.J. Schachter, who wrote about this. Their article was interesting because it was not a question of did this happen, did this not happen, but to understand the Jewish response to such situations. And they saw this as a topology, which the name of their article is The 93 Beth Jacob Girls of Krakow History or Topology. Okay? And it's easy to find. If you can't find it, you can contact. I'm happy to send you a copy of it. I have it at home. Okay. Now, as the years went on, and I'll say it again, initially this was taken absolutely as true. Again, there were major cities in Israel that went and named streets after them, including Tel Aviv, Haifa, Petah Tikva, Netanya, Rishon LeZion. Bnei Brak has a gan. It's taught in various schools. The way that it's taught if you went to a Beit Yaakov would have been, these girls died, you better dress sneezistically. That was basically the... Anybody go to Beis Yaakov? Am I exaggerating? Is that how it was taught? So Holocaust scholars, obviously, they look into this and they start asking difficult questions. Hold it. Where were they before they were arrested? Where did they get the poison from? How did the letter get out? Again, all kinds of... Why is it that nobody who was in Warsaw or Krakow or Warsaw ever heard about this? Why anybody who was there at the time never heard about a pile of bodies? Again, by the way, you could say it didn't work. They didn't commit suicide. It never happened. Why? But I'm saying everything is good about it except for the various details that you can check. By the way, there's another letter that materialized afterwards that has different dates on it. Same story. And the 94th girl says, I was standing out the window and I was outside watching as this was happening and they're all dead, but the dates are all wrong on it. So there's something very strange going on. Now, I'm not going to ask the question, did this happen, did this not happen? That doesn't interest me. It would interest me, but it's not. I don't have the tools to evaluate it. If you were to contact Yad Vashem and you were to ask Yad Vashem, do you have any information on this? They have a whole file on this, and their answer will be that this is not a historical story. Now, by the way, that itself is disturbing. It's disturbing because there's enough people in the world who question the Holocaust as a whole that we don't need to add to that by telling over stories that never happened. So I'm saying that there's enough horrific things. You want women that were prostituted in death camps? Okay, I know, I can tell you afterwards, I know of real cases. I know of real people that such things happen to. By the way, one or two or three, yes. 93, a little harder to believe. They say in the letter, it says they were arrested by the Gestapo. If they're arrested by the Gestapo did keep the laws of purity. When I say not, that's not Taras Mishracha, by the way. They kept the laws of purity in terms of the Aryan purity laws, and they did not or would never have allowed such a thing. To say that other German or more likely Polish soldiers may have done such a thing, that's completely possible. But what I'm just saying is that the various things which are said about this make those who study Holocaust history come to the conclusion, like, what are we talking about? Okay, so full stop. So, you remember what I told you about earlier, about the Midbar and the Nachash and the so on? So, what I've decided is that this story... Now, let me pause there in mid-sentence. I don't know who wrote it. There's one person who, in the various study that I looked into, said that he spoke to the person who wrote it, and he made it up. Okay, that's as far as I can get you. But even if somebody made up such a story, I'd have to ask myself a couple questions. One obvious question would be why? And the answer why is easy. Why? Because it is a kind of a letter which is very moving. It can get people very, very upset. It hit all the right buttons. The virginal, nice, Beis Yaakov girl's about to be used in the most sordid possible way, and therefore this sense that we better do something about this, and how can we let such things happen? So, again, as I said, all the right buttons were pushed over here. But I'll tell you what the starting point for me was. I found the Midbar. I found the desert. I found the point in the letter which I believe will allow us to reconstruct exactly what happened. When I say exactly what happened, I mean this on a literary level. What was going on in the mind of the person who wrote this? Now, you started looking up right away over there. What were you looking up?
I was looking up how many days after Tisha B'Av it was because of the Kina, the 27th that you had given.
It's right after Tisha B'Av. I looked that up as well.
Okay.
It's right after Tisha B'Av, which means that the date of the original letter was right after he had written, and which Kina I gave you here, or...
The one of the brother and the sister, and the...
That's a nice one also, but...
That was what I was thinking of, because when I read it every year, I think I always combine those two stories in my head.
First, the Matuza Gemara, which you may be familiar with, Amar of Yehuda, Amar Shmuel. Here, by the way, is the topology. This Gemara is actually cited by professors Schechter and Schwartz. Amar of Yehuda, Amar Shmuel, the Itamar of the Ami, the Amri Lebavadita Tana. Okay, stop. Amar of Yehuda, Amar Shmuel. Rav Yehuda reported the name of Shmuel. Rav Yehuda is one of the main Amorayim in the land of Bavel. He had two teachers. His first teacher was Rav. Rav passed away. He becomes a student of Shmuel. Two different academies, Sura Pumpadita, Amr Rav Yehuda Mishmuel, the Epema, but some people say Rav Yami. Some people say, no, you're from Rav Yami. But Amri Love, but some say, so now you already have the same, we're just now told the same thing has three different possibilities of where it came from. But Amri Love of Atita time, and some was, no, this was taught in the school. This is what was said in the yeshivas. Ma'aseh, once upon a time, ba'arba me'ot yiladim biladot, there was a story of 400 boys and girls, shenishbu l'kalon, who were kidnapped, and they were going to be used for sexual purposes. Hirgishu ba'atzmam l'mahim mitbakshim. They sensed among themselves for what they were going to be used. This, by the way, is during the time right after the Second Temple was destroyed. They're taken off in boats to Rome. Amru, they say, Im anu tov im biyam, anu ba'im l'chayilam haba. If we were to kill ourselves, jump into the water, before they get to us, will we have a share in the world to come? Now, I have to stop right over here. Because, you know, when you say a typology in terms of, it becomes a certain way that in our minds, which is engraved, this is how Jews have behaved. Now, this story, and others like it, are used when the rabbis from France, Balei Tosfot generally, discuss the permissibility of killing yourself, of suicide, rather than to be involved in what we would call a major, major sin. So I just want to use two different points of history. One point of history is the sexual problem, which over here is being presented because Rome is waiting for these boys and girls, these young men and young women. In the Middle Ages, what was it? It was the cross. It was forced baptism. And then the choice was, am I better off killing myself rather than be forced to convert? So let's hold there for a second and continue what the Gemara says. Will we have a share in the world to come if we kill ourselves? Now, why would you say no? So here's where I can stop for a second and switch and say, okay, let's analyze this in terms of halacha. Now, we all know halacha to various extent, correct? If somebody, God forbid, is sick on a Shabbat, are you allowed to call an ambulance?
Yes.
Why? Koach nefesh breaks Shabbat, right? But how? You're not... Okay. But by the way, you realize now that a rabbi answering the question in a vacuum, oh, the rabbi in London said it's better to use a non-Jew to drive. That may not be true in this particular part of the world, in this particular time. So I'm just, you need to think a little about this. So, pikuach nefesh is docheh Shabbat. We all know that. It's all basic. It's easy. A matter of fact, Judaism says that life takes precedence over just about all the commandments, but except for a couple. And what are those couple that are not included? So, also we know those. What are they? Okay, let's go in no particular order. Idolatry, sexual sins, and what's the third one? Murder. Okay, good. Murder. Now, does it make any logical sense to you that you'd be allowed to kill yourself in order to avoid idolatry? Aren't they both among the three things that you can't do? Or you're going to say, no, it's different because you're allowed to kill yourself. Because Judaism says murder is only when you murder somebody else. But if you murder... Oh, 1 second. Are you all being fooled right now because I use the word suicide? What if you kill your brother? It's fratricide. It's not murder. Is there a word for killing your mother-in-law? Like, mother-in-law aside? I don't know.
You don't have one, so
you're okay. So, no, should that be allowed because it's not murder? Okay, good. Why? What's that to say? Who ever said that suicide is not considered murder? So you don't have to answer that question. If anything, and if you analyze this halachically, the only sad conclusion you're going to find is that suicide may be worse than murder. Killed. You should be killed rather than do it. So Rabbeinu Tam did a very, very fancy two-step. And both of the steps can be debated. One step was, as he said, well, apparently, if it's Yehor Vayavar, it's better to die than to do these three things. So therefore, it's better to kill yourself than do one of these three things. And that's a leap. That's a huge leap, actually. Because I can argue that killing yourself is one of those three things. Rabbeinu Tam says, no, you can kill yourself in order not to break one of those three things. Now, then he said, well, not only can you kill yourself not to do one of these three things, you can also kill your kids that they don't do one of these three things. And you end up saying, what? Now, I'm not going to get any more into this than I need. If you're interested, you can read historians, halachic historians from the history. Best one would be Professor Chaim Soloveitchik, who comes to the conclusion, and again, I want you to understand his analysis. He says it's interesting that when the Rambam discusses things like Yehorg Vayavar, he uses all of the halachic gemaras that discuss it. When the Balei HaTosfot discuss it, they use Agadata to discuss it. And that's fascinating. That's not the way we paskin halacha. We don't paskin halacha based on Agadata. Like, what happened to Rabbeinu Tam? And Professor Chaim, Rav Chaim, I once had him as a substitute teacher. The Rav was sick for a couple of months, and he took his place. And he was probably the best teacher I ever had. He was absolutely overwhelming intellectually, absolutely overwhelming. But Professor Soloveitchik said as follows. He said that Rabbeinu Tam had a problem. You had entire communities in Ashkenaz who committed suicide rather than to convert. So what are you going to do when you know, based upon your halachic analysis, that they're all considered terrible sinners? Just 1 second, stop right there. Because they weren't allowed to kill themselves. So based on halachic analysis, they couldn't have. So what do? You work very hard, and you find whatever sources you can to come and say that these holy people were, in fact, holy people who rather died than to be converted. And he's saying, Rabbeinu Tam is of the opinion, we are not starting up with Kedoshe Ashkenaz. We're not starting up with the martyrs of Ashkenaz who chose death, sometimes to be killed, sometimes to kill, and sometimes to kill others. You want to read a frightening document? You can read the commentary of the Balei HaTosfot on Bereishit Perek Tet Pasuk Hey and Vav, where you have Shafech Dam Adam B'damo Yishafech, where you have a story told over there of somebody who killed a whole town of children in order to avoid the Crusaders who were on the way. And another one of the Balei HaTosfot was there and said, "What are you doing?" And at the end, they never came into that town. You have a ritva quoting and saying, but Rabbeinu Tam allowed it, and what can we do? Kfar Haru Zaken, the elder. Rabbeinu Tam already said this was okay. Now, I'm going to go back and say this again. When I read this, Gemara, right in the middle over here, this is the source that you can kill yourself. Now, go back to that question. See, the Gemara, and now we're going to come back and get back to where we're going with this. The Gemara over here never asked, is this allowed or is it not allowed? What is the context of Gemara? A whole bunch of kids in a boat, traveling away in a boat, saying to themselves, well, look, they start looking around, and I'm embellishing a little bit, and they notice that all the boys are all the pretty boys and all the girls are all the pretty girls, and a rumor then spreads that you're going to be used as sexual slaves for the rest of their lives. And then they say, and if we kill ourselves beforehand, what happens? Do we have a share in the world to come? And at that point, one of the kids stands up, Darashlan Agadul Shabahem, the eldest of the kids. You realize the tragedy? The eldest of the kids gets up and says, Amar Hashem, thus God said, Mi Boshan Ashiv. Ashiv Mi Mitzolot Yam. And he makes a drasha, the words are similar. I will bring you back from the depths of the sea. Mi Boshan Ashiv Mi Ben Shnei Aryeh Ashiv. Mi Mitzolot Yam, Eile Shetovim Beyam. Those who jump in the sea, I will bring them back. Kevin Sheshamu Yiladot Kach. When the girls heard this, kafzu kulav naflu toch hayam, they all jumped into the water and they killed themselves. Nasu yiladim kal v'choma batzlam. Then the boy said, hold it, there's a kal v'choma here. V'amu ma lo shadar kan l'kach, kach. The girls, who what they would have done to them would have been considered to be natural, anu, she'in dar kein l'kach, that which they do to us will not be considered a natural deed. Allah et kam v'chama, all the more so, Avhim kafzu l'toch hayam, they all jumped into the sea as well. V'leim ha'katav omer, and this is the conclusion of the Gemara, ki alecha haragnu kol hayom, nechshavnu kitzon tivcha. We were killed the entire day, we went like sheep to slaughter. Now the Gemara over here never made a value judgment. Is this right? Is it wrong? Is it good? Is it bad? What is the point of the Gemara? Is to tell us the tragedy of the Churban. The tragedy of the Churban was not exclusively the fact that a building came down. The tragedy of the Churban was many, many, many lives that were destroyed. Children who've... you get it? The tragedy here is not just the death. The tragedy is little kids having to ask themselves this question. If we kill ourselves, we'll go to Olam Haba? Can we not? And who knows if this kid is right or wrong? Are you going to tell me this kid knew that Rabbeinu Tam is going to say this all those years later? And by the way, based upon this and a couple of other agadot. So this, it's a story. It's a tragedy. Okay, now, full stop, because now we have all the information we need. A couple of years ago, on Tisha B'Av, I have a terrible habit. I try to understand what the keynote means. In my shul, it's terrible. We actually have a time limit, how long the keynote lasts. The reason there was a time limit, because I have to speak someplace else afterwards, so that's the time limit. It's till I have to go, so there's a time limit, and we're only going to say whatever the time limit is, an hour, whatever, for argument's sake, amount. Doesn't make a difference how many we say, but either before or after we read it, then I have to explain it, and we've never finished the whole book. But as I'm reading it, I'm thinking, and now again, it's two things, because what am I going to say, and sometimes what does this mean, and looking for symbolisms and so on. So let's look at source number three. This is one of the, you can't use the word beautiful. Can you give me a different word to use? Moving, meaningful. Keynote of Elazar HaKalir, one of the most talented writers we've ever had. No one really knows when he lived, most likely 9th century. And let's start. Zochor asher asat tsar bifni. Remember what the enemy did inside. Shalaf charbo ubalufnai avlufnim. So you have this rhyme going on between bifnim, lifnim, bifnim. So this is when Titus went inside. This is told over the Gemara. He pulled out his sword. One of the things that he did is that he stabbed the curtain, which was then started to bleed. Mechalteinu ba'et ketimei lechem apanim. He kicked aside our heritage when he made the lechem apanim tamei. Bigider parochet ba'alat shtei panim. And he pierced the parochet that had two sides. Yitomim gi'al b'magein ma'adam, and over here we switched from the panim rhyme to adam, which is red, which we're about to do. A lot of things have to do with red and blood and so on. He caused disgust to orphans with his blood-soaked shield. Vayamdeid kav kimar'eh adamdam. He drew a line of blood. Mimenu dolach v'hishkir chitzav midam. Our war days were sullied as his arrows were full of blood. Okay, so as I said, he starts with, again, I just want to pay attention to the images here, goes all the way to the inside. Next, images of blood. We're skipping a little bit. Avotenu zara ki hichnisu bachurav achla esh, vizet so'az zona hichnis bilo nichva ba'esh. Okay, I want to pause on those two lines, because those two lines are very important. What was the first line that he made reference to? The Nadav and Avihu. Nadav and Avihu can go and do something they shouldn't have done, and what happened? They immediately got burnt with fire. What we have then is a deep theological problem. How could it be that this Rasha goes lifnai v'lifnim into the inner sanctuary, into the Kodesh HaKadoshim, and nothing happens to him? But then it added one more thing. V'zet so azona hichnis v'lo nichva ba'esh. Not only did he walk inside there, but he grabbed a prostitute by the hand, and he was intimate with her in the middle of the temple. So what we just now have over here is panim, the inner part, blood flowing, images of blood, fire now coming on, prostitution. Abadim chitu b'toch labat esh v'alma b'esh b'beit esh imarom shalach esh. V'samam ba'ani shayit bam lahisharet. Arar namak shehishkim misharet v'lo matza tishim u'shlosha klei sharet. It talks about now, again, temple being destroyed, prostitution in the temple. Ships were used, we're going to come more to the ships soon, in order to try to take away the holy vessels. But then it says, our skin crawled when the Kohen woke up. Now that itself is fascinating. According to this, the Kohen Gadol slept through all of this. There's a reason for this image, which I need to explain. The Kohen Gadol is, in a certain sense, and don't go too far with this, is in a certain sense the representative of God. The reason why it has the Kohen Gadol sleeping is because the Kina over here is accusing God of sleeping. As I said, there's some real strong theological arguments which are being pushed forth over here. One argument is, how could you kill Nadav and Avihu who are trying to serve you and do nothing to this man who sleeps with a prostitute in not just the Beis HaMikdash, in the Kodesh HaKadoshim, the Holy of Holies? God, where are you? There's a scream here. God, where are you? And what are we told? The Kohen Gadol then wakes up in the morning, but what happens? He looks around, and all the kelim are missing. What's the number of the kelim that it gave? How many utensils were there? So the answer is 93. Hold it. How does the Kalir know that there's 93? Because it's a Mishnah. It happens to be a Mishnah in Tumim. So get Tumim. So it's, again, it's one of these things we never learn, but then it lists that there are 93 kelim. So did you all figure out what I'm guessing over here? What I'm guessing is that whoever wrote that letter
had the word rate, the word 93, and saw that, you
know. He was writing a kina.
What was the title I gave you for the class? The creation of a modern midrash and the Holocaust. What he did is on Tisha B'Av.
It could have been a shoe.
Yes. On Tisha B'Av, the author is sitting and reading the keynote and sitting on the floor. And you know, sometimes we have a hard time focusing on Tisha B'Av, and right? And you know what? In 1942, it wasn't hard at all to focus on Tisha B'Av, because all the images which are written in this Kina are jumping out because they're all taking place, and there are Jews being burned, and there's fire, and all of our holy places. And this image of the 93 holy vessels which disappear. By the way, when I saw this, I was completely convinced. I actually, the only one who I saw that again, so far, it could be that I just haven't looked far enough, the only one who I saw who connected this with the 93 Vesyakov girls, as I found a couple of weeks ago, that in a footnote at the very end of the book, she says that it seems to be that this is connected, but she didn't connect it to the Kina really. She didn't do what we're doing. She said, "Oh, the number 93 is used sometimes, you know, to describe the Kalim." So the Mishnah Talmud she got to. But let's read a little bit more, because I think it's going to get a lot stronger. Nashim kashru kiva aritz bekarka bayit nalah haferitz sarim luftaroch kavo paritz v'veid kodesh v'rim tzach nato hishritz. So literally, as descriptive as you can possibly be, it talks about this man taking the prostitute and being intimate with her right there, describing it really, really vividly. By the way, that's right after the 93. I'm going to skip a little bit. You, God, were angry and allowed this expulsion to take place. Innocent children were taken out. Why did you let all these nations come in and you ignored the Korban Mincha that was brought over the years? And you sent them off to this faraway place in various boats. Hashivenu shivu kavo b'nivchayam v'shitfu atzmam yachad v'po bayam. That's referring to the Gemara that we read before. You sent them off in the sea, and they went and they conspired together to jump off of the boats into the sea. Shir v'tishvachot shiru ka'al yam. They sang the songs, remember the psalms that we had in the letter? They sang the songs as they jumped into the sea. Ki alecha haragnu b'mitzolot yam. Quoting the pasuk that the Gemara quoted to back it up. Ki tahamot bo ad nafsham, because the water came and took them and they drowned. Kol zot batanu v'lo shachachnucha chilu l'mamashan. All of this happened and you didn't forget. Tikvatam natnu l'meshiv mi'bashan. There's still hope for those who will return from the Bashan, which again is the question that was asked by the children in that Agadah that we cited. Ubat kol nishma'a, and a voice came out and screamed out, now this is interesting, from heaven or to heaven, Ura lama tishan, wake up, why are you sleeping? So, I want to say this again. The various keynote that we read, and yes, you really do need to read them properly and to learn them and to understand them, and the imagery, the language isn't simple, and it's poetry. And sometimes we feel completely lost. And yes, I believe it's better to read a lot less of them well than to read a lot of them. But when you read this kina, which is a very difficult kina, it does throw out this theological question. You have the Kohen Gadol sleeping, and how does it end? It ends with a scream. What's the scream at the end? Wake up. Wake up. It has the children who killed themselves singing songs of psalms, something the Gemara didn't have. And where else did we notice that entering? I said this a minute ago. Where did it go? It entered into the letter as well. That we're singing, we're learning the words of the Tehillim, we're learning the words of David right now as we prepare ourselves. Okay, so I'm going to say it again. I have no idea who wrote it. Man, woman, I have no idea who wrote this letter. I don't know exactly what they were thinking either, but I'll give you what my suspicion is. My suspicion is they wrote a new kina. Consciously, or it's very hard to say. They took this kina and they updated it. They took all the elements which are in over here and they updated it. And again, you can go back to try to analyze how many of these elements are here. Essentially, they're all here. The girls become the holy vessels, and that's why it's 93. This is the place which... This is the holy thing over here is the Beit Yaakov, so if you want, you have a feminist shift on it. But of course, I understand why that happened. Over here, the Kina spoke about prostitution in its holy place, but now you have prostitution in its holy place with these girls. But then the Kina then jumped. The letter is first following the Kina. It jumped, and what did it do in the second half? It talked about the kids are going off in the boat and then jumped off and they killed themselves in order to avoid whatever that next stage would be. And then we have the girls going and killing themselves. And so on and so forth. So as I read it, and yes, what was the key point for me? Go ahead, say it. What was the key point in this whole thing? The number 93.
Yeah,
but also the end, awaken, why do you sleep? That was why it got into the New York Times.
That was the purpose.
Call for help.
It was a call for help, call for action, to wake up the Jewish community. Where are you? Where are you? And it's as if the writer, again, has this opened in front of them, and they write this new call for help and scream, but it's just not necessarily that they ever even imagine that they're writing something which is meant to be historical. Again, I can't say, I don't know. But what I do know, again, no, what I do strongly suspect is that this is where it's coming from. Remember something. The Jewish community did very, very little during the Holocaust. It's not nice to say. Do you know the name of the person who probably did more than anyone else in America? Let's see what name you pick. What? Peter Bergson or Hillel Cook did probably more than anybody else. And he's been very much forgotten. But Hillel Cook was the one who was organized the March on Washington, which I can proudly say my great-grandfather was one of the rabbis who marched in Washington. Did it do much? I don't know. The president refused to meet with them. But if you don't know about it, I mean, there were over 100 rabbis who went to protest. The Jews didn't protest. We didn't go off in the streets. There were more Jews, and I don't say, don't get take this the wrong way, there were more Jews who were involved in protests during the Civil Rights Movement than they were during the Holocaust. It was a different time. It was a different cause. We were scared still in America. We didn't think we can stand up. We didn't think we would have any kind of impact, but we didn't. He also organized a major rally in Madison Square Garden. But again, a few things. And here you have this letter, somebody screaming out, wake up, wake up. They're killing us. The 93 are gone. But as I said, I'm reading this as a midrash. I'm reading this as if the text, again, just like I did in the beginning, there was the text of the Chumash and the Midrash using the text of the Chumash and giving us various images and then using those images in order to give us an interpretation. Over here, the primary text becomes the Kinah of Elazar HaKalir. That's the primary text. Of course, that's based upon other things as well, including verses and including various Midrashim, various Gemarot, and various Psukim. There is what's special about this is there's a scream out to God, why are you not being fair? How could holy people be killed, another ben Avihu, and how could people who are so guilty just walk in there and nothing happen to them? How could people desecrate things which are holy? Kohen Gadol sleeping through it while the 93 disappear. That is such a strong image. And in the very end, it comes out with that scream, which is, wake up. So as far as I can tell, what we have in front of us is not an attempt at Holocaust, I don't know what you want to call it, a revisionism or not revisionism. It has nothing to do with this. It is a literary creation where too often, what do we do when we read such things? We go into our binary approach. True or not true? If it is true, oh, this is a terrible story. If it's not true, well, what a terrible thing to do. Stop. Let's not read it that way. Let's read it. Again, I don't know the motivation. I don't know what they're trying to do. I do hear a scream. And the scream I only hear because I go back to what I think it's based on, and that's the Kinah, and that is wake up. That's what I hear. But if we read it as a midrash, and that's what I think it is, if we read it as a midrash, where somebody's looking at what's going on in Europe and saying, I need to describe this to people. I need to explain what this is. I need to articulate what is going on over here. And they sit down and they write a modern, up-to-date, unfortunately, based upon the news, I can literally say New York Times, but it's better than that, based upon what's happening outside in Europe, as Europe is, choose your metaphor, up in flames, everything holy being destroyed, and sit down and write. And the fact that it was written a couple of days after Tisha B'Av, I think strengthens the point. They read this Kinah, tears, whoever it was, tears coming down their cheeks, and they say, I have to update this so people who are sleeping still understand what's going on. So as I said, that is how I understand this particular letter. I understand it as being a new midrash.